We were talking about ATP and its role as the energy currency. What we're seeing in slide 9 is just one example of how ATP is used, so this specific example doesn't really matter. This is a real reaction, but the important concept applies to many other reactions. The point here is that metabolism consists of anabolic reactions and catabolic reactions, right? And we can also remember that anabolic reactions are endergonic, right? There's all kinds of endergonic processes, including chemical reactions, that cells have to undergo in order to remain alive. If they don't do those things, they die. But as we've already talked about, endergonic processes are never going to happen by themselves because you have to put energy into them by definition of being endergonic. ATP is important in this role because it's an energetic intermediary. Just like we don't work directly for food, we work for money and then spend money on food. ATP is the intermediary between energy released from exergonic reactions that are occurring. That's what happens when we burn fuels, for instance. ATP stores that energy, and then energy from ATP afterwards being released can power the endergonic processes. And specifically what we're seeing here is that when it comes to reactions, if you couple an exergonic reaction, which is releasing energy, to an endergonic reaction, then you can force that endergonic reaction to occur. The endergonic reaction, the specific one used as an example here, is shown above. Glutamic acid is an amino acid. It's one of the 20 biological amino acids. If you react that with ammonia, you form glutamine, which is something the cell needs. That's why this is a necessary endergonic reaction. But it's endergonic by definition because delta G is positive, right? It's not going to work unless you supply energy. Okay, well, look at the row below that. Here we have glutamic acid reacting with ATP in such a way that ATP gets dephosphorylated. It loses one of its three phosphates, which gets stuck onto glutamic acid, forming an activated phosphorylated glutamic acid with phosphate attached to it. And since that came from ATP, what's left over is ADP. Okay? Just like ATP is carrying energy because of that phosphate, this energized glutamic acid, because of that phosphate, is activated in a sense. And when you have an activated phosphorylated glutamic acid reacting with ammonia, then you can form the glutamine, and the phosphate pops off because it gets replaced by the ammonia to form that glutamine, and you have inorganic phosphate on its own. All right, so in the bottom, we have the overall balance sheet as far as energy is concerned. This first reaction in the bottom is the endergonic reaction that we see pictured above. Delta G of positive 3.4 kilocalories per mole. Below is the hydrolysis of ATP. That's what you're coupling this process with. Hydrolysis of ATP means you're stripping it of one phosphate, right? That forms ADP and inorganic phosphate. That process by itself is exergonic. It has a delta G of negative 7.3 kilocalories per mole. So if you couple the two, really what you're doing is taking two thermodynamic systems, combining them into one thermodynamic system. Right? And the overall delta G then is the sum of the two delta G's. And notice that when you add 3.4 and negative 7.3, you get negative 3.9. So the overall coupling of the two becomes exergonic, and therefore it's going to happen. All right? Does that all make sense energetically? So ATP provides negative 7.3, it puts out, that's the negative, 7.3 kilocalories per mole. What if it were the case that this glutamic acid reaction required exactly 7.3 kilocalories per mole. In other words, instead of being positive 3.4, it's positive 7.3. Would this work? It would not work, and why wouldn't it? Not exactly. What would be the problem with ATP providing exactly the amount of energy required for the endergonic process?
There'd be no leftover energy to put the phosphate back on?
Well, no, because that's not even a requirement.
Put the phosphate back onto ATP, or onto ADP.
Yeah, that doesn't... When you... Just like, you know, in the currency comparison, when you spend money on a debit card, there's no guarantee that you're going to make a deposit again. You don't have to. The problem would be something we discussed. The problem with releasing exactly the amount of energy that's required is that you can never use all of that, right? Because of what? The second law of thermodynamics tells you that no thermodynamic process is 100% efficient. So some of that available energy is going to be wasted as heat, and therefore it wouldn't be enough. But notice that hydrolysis of ATP is actually more than enough. So even with the heat loss, the waste, you still have enough to drive the endergonic process. And this is how ATP works in all kinds of other endergonic situations as well. Now in slide 10, we're looking at two major categories of cellular work that spending ATP can accomplish. Okay, by spending ATP, I'm talking about hydrolyzing ATP, right? Getting some of its energy out of that terminal phosphate-phosphate bond. So when you split it and turn it into ADP, energy is released, and there's two major categories of cellular work that can be performed because of that release of energy. On the top, we see what's labeled as transport work, but that's not actually a really good phrase. The more specific phrase here, what we're really talking about in whoever wrote this book, is transmembrane transport. It's not just moving something generically, it's specifically moving something through a membrane, either into the cell or out of the cell. We've already discussed that that can happen on its own, right? That's what diffusion through a membrane would be. And that's driven by the gradient. Well, you wouldn't need ATP to help you do that. So specifically the transmembrane transport work we're talking about here that requires ATP, or that ATP can provide the energy for, would be pumping, in other words, active transport through a membrane, either into or out of the cell. That's a major category. And the other one on the bottom is so-called mechanical work, which is referring not to getting things into or out of cells through membranes, but instead moving things from place to place within the cell, using these motor proteins, for example, like we've already talked about. Every individual step of a motor protein requires a fresh ATP molecule, hydrolyzed into ADP and inorganic phosphate. The next step is going to take another one, so it's expensive to move things around. But your ATP pool, you know, you have quadrillions of these adenosine nucleotides in your cells of your body. Some of at any given moment, a certain fraction of that pool is ATP, a certain fraction is ADP, and a certain fraction is AMP. Usually the AMP fraction is really small, right? And under normal circumstances, it's just going back and forth between ADP and ATP. But ADP here is the product because you're releasing energy, you're spending the energy. ADP can then be rephosphorylated back into ATP. And that's what you do when you burn fuels that came into your body as food originally. You're making deposits into those debit cards.
Well, I mean, you need like several times, several hundreds of thousands of, I'd say even millions of ATP to even run a single cell?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Millions is nothing compared to quadrillions.
Fair enough.
So, and God. Yeah, there are millions of these things.
Millions.
Even in cells, even in a single cell. And there are 100 trillion cells in your body, all of which have millions.
Which means it would be a million of a million of a million.
That's right. Huge numbers. Well, a million million is
right.
A trillion.
Yeah, it would be pentillion.
Yeah. Oh, no, pentillion.
Ten? That's fine.
Right, but from 3 to 5 is a million times.
Oh, I was going one extra.
Okay, 11. Slide 11 is just another schematic representation of what I've been talking about as ATP being the energetic intermediary or the energy currency. It's an intermediary because it comes between the two processes. An exergonic process that is releasing energy, that's the burning of a fuel, and the input of energy into an endergonic process that you're trying to drive to make happen in the cell. It's not a direct process. The energy doesn't come directly from the exergonic reaction to force the endergonic reaction. Instead, the energy from the exergonic reaction is captured, of course, not all of it, some of it's wasted as heat, but some of it is captured in the form of ATP, which is now temporarily carrying the energy, and it can be very temporary. I mean, it can be just a tiny fraction of a second after this ATP is produced, it's spent. But it's temporarily storing it, and then when you release the energy from ATP, what you're really doing is hydrolyzing it. That's why the water's here. That releases the energy because you're splitting that terminal phosphate, and the energy released, some of that's lost as heat too, but some of it is able to drive the endergonic process that you're trying to force happen. That, of course, leaves a partially spent nucleotide. ADP is partially spent because it still has valuable energy in it, right? Just not as much as it did when it had 3 phosphates. So it can get renewed by undergoing another burning of a fuel, an exergonic process to capture the energy to force it into ATP again. All right, 12. Once again, this particular example isn't really the important thing here. The example, as you see, is sucrose at the top, which is what? What is sucrose? It's not a simple sugar. It's a disaccharide. But it's table sugar, which is, you know, usually when we say sugar in everyday life, we're specifically referring to sucrose, a disaccharide. And it's being split here in this process. So that's a hydrolysis reaction, as you should know by now. Sucrose is not only a disaccharide, but specifically the two monosaccharides that are hooked together to form it are glucose and fructose. So when you split sucrose or hydrolyze sucrose, the products are glucose and fructose. So that's not really the point. That's just a specific example. But by the way, just by way of review, what has to be broken in order to do this? What do you have to break in sucrose to break it into the two monosaccharides?
The oxygen bond between them.
So that's what it's called, the oxygen bond?
Don't remember entirely.
What's the real name of the bond between the monosaccharides? It's a glycosidic linkage, right. So that's what's happening here. It's a hydrolysis that specifically breaks the glycosidic linkage between the two constituent monosaccharides. Now we can get to the final point, the real point of the slide, which is this sucrase word. What is sucrase? Is different from sucrose. Sucrose is the sugar. Well, sucrose. What? Go ahead. What were you saying?
Isn't that an enzyme?
It is an enzyme. You should be able to tell that it's an enzyme because it's not on either end of the arrow, like I was talking about before, right? Reactants and products are on either end of the arrow. this is a vertical arrow. Normally we look at horizontal arrows, and I said above or below it, well, here it would be to one side of it. You list enzyme names because they are not reactants. They don't get turned into anything. But sucrase reminds me to tell you that enzymes, there's thousands of enzymes, different kinds of enzymes, and enzymes individually have names, of course, but there's two major ways that a lot of enzymes are named. There are exceptions to this, but any given enzyme is likely to be named in one of two ways. Either it's named for what it does, or it's named for the substrate that it's specific for. And the word substrate is simply the name for, the generic name for the reactant in that catalyzed reaction that the enzyme is part of. In other words, substrate is reactant that an enzyme binds to turn it into product. But another thing about naming is that enzyme names, to remind you that they're enzymes, are end in A-S-E. O-S-E endings tell you that that's a carbohydrate of some size. It could be a monosaccharide, a disaccharide, or a polysaccharide. A-S-E means that thing is an enzyme. And so I just told you the two major ways that most enzymes are named, and this happens to be an example of an enzyme that gets its name from its substrate. Its substrate is sucrose, so the enzyme was named sucrase. And importantly, enzymes are specific. We've talked about this a little bit before. But this sucrase enzyme is named that because it works on sucrose and not other things. If you want to split apart something else, you need to go find the right enzyme to do that. This enzyme works this way for only this substrate. Okay, now to 13. We're going to look at a couple graphs in this and the next slide, illustrating the progress of a reaction, which is really time, right? Before the reaction happened and after the reaction happened. And as you see on the y-axis, we're plotting free energy, known as what? What's the symbol for free energy? G. Not delta G, G. So any given instantaneous value of free energy is a G value. A specific Y value here is a G. Delta G is how much that changes. So you need two values to calculate a delta, right? Before and after. Well, A, B, C, and D here don't really, those aren't real things. You don't find A, B, C, and D as symbols by themselves on the periodic table. These represent some atoms. It's just generic. But notice that the reactants at first are molecules made of A and B together and C and D together, two separate molecules. In general, any given chemical reaction that occurs will occur only if certain bonds get broken and certain new bonds get formed. There's a rearrangement, as we've talked about in chemical reactions. And that's what's being illustrated here generically. So the bond is between A and B originally and between C and D originally, two reactants in this case. The products have a rearrangement so that A is now bonded to C and B is bonded to D. So the reaction doesn't happen unless certain bonds break and certain other bonds form. But that does not happen instantaneously. It doesn't just pop into the situation of the product. It actually takes, that rearrangement takes some time during which the stuff you have is no longer reactant, but it's not yet product. It's somewhere in between. And that's what we call the transition state, which is drawn here with squiggle lines because these bonds are being stressed. They're not nice permanent bonds, so to speak, as they were in the reactant. They're in the process of being broken. Well, look what's happening with G. The G value for the transition state, which you have to get through in order to get to the products, in order for the reaction to occur, that G, or free energy value, is higher than both the reactant's value and the product's value. It's the peak of this black trace. That's the highest energy of the whole thing. But what this means, practically speaking, is that this is an energetic hill that has to be climbed. You have to get over this energetic hill or this reaction's not going to occur. And notice what kind of reaction this is. You're starting with a G value here. You're ending up with a lower G value in the products. So it's what kind of reaction? It's exergonic, which you would expect to be what kind of reaction in terms of whether or not it will happen on its own? Spontaneous. But remember I said spontaneous doesn't necessarily mean it's going to happen soon, just that it can happen on its own, right? This is illustrating why it might not happen soon, even though it's spontaneous. Depends on how big this hill is. If this is a lower hill, it would be more likely for this to happen, because there would be enough thermal energy because of the movement of the materials to get over this hump. But this graph is drawn for an exergonic reaction. You could also draw one for an endergonic reaction, which of course would have a lower G to start and a higher G to end. The point here, though, is that it still has a transition state, and even for an exergonic reaction, the transition state is higher than both the reactant and product Gs. All right? So what's true of this is true of both exergonic and endergonic. All right, now this is important because we're going to see how an enzyme works. We already know what enzymes do. They speed up reactions, but the point is, what do they actually do that? Well, this brings in a definition of what's called activation energy, or energy of activation, or symbolically E sub A. Notice graphically what E sub A is. It is not the entire range of G here. The energy of activation is just how much more energy above what the reactants have you have to supply in order to get it to the top of that hill. Right? Just this distance. That's energy of activation. And another important point about this is that delta G, which we've already talked about, the difference between the G of the reactants and the G of the products, notice that that is not at all part of E sub A. That's a totally different range. The only things that matter for delta G are the beginning G and the ending G. The between stuff does not matter at all, right? Kind of like if, you know, the distance between me and you is a certain distance. If I walk down the hall first and then come back, this distance is still the same. Okay, those are some important definitions. Now, let's look at the same slide in 14, the same graph, I mean, that we just looked at. The black trace is the one that we just looked at. Now we have a red trace, though, overlaid on it. And the red trace, notice, has a lower activation energy, a lower hill that you have to get over. Well, that's exactly what enzymes in general do. They can accomplish it many different ways depending on this particular enzyme and the particular substrate. But whatever they're doing specifically, all enzymes operate by lowering the activation energy. And if they lower it enough, then the thermal energy of the system is enough to just get it right over that hill, which is why it will happen so much more quickly with the enzyme's help. But I want you to appreciate that what the enzyme does here, which is to reduce the activation energy, does not ever change the value of delta G. The delta G, like I said, only depends on the beginning G and the ending G, and the enzyme never affects that. That's just because of what the particular reactant is and what the particular product is. So the delta G is the same whether the enzyme is working or not, whether it's catalyzed. The enzyme, if it's there, will reduce activation energy and it will leave delta G untouched. So another way of saying that is that the enzyme does not change how much energy is put out or taken in. Taken in the case of an endergonic reaction, yeah.
Did it react spontaneously?
Yeah, the only thing that matters to the spontaneity is the delta G, and the enzyme doesn't affect that, as I was just saying. So, yeah, the enzyme does not change the spontaneity. It will change the speed of the reaction because it changes the enzyme, energy of activation. Now to 15. The blue thing we see here is an enzyme. Now, what are enzymes, molecularly speaking? Well, that's functionally speaking. They are proteins, right? And that can be either a single polypeptide or it can be a multimeric protein. But they're proteins. In general, proteins acting as catalysts. And I've already said that enzymes are specific, meaning an enzyme will work with only a certain kind of substrate. Now, sometimes it can be actually more than one substrate, but they're very highly related to each other. An enzyme won't work on just anything. It has to be the right specific shape, because there is a correspondence between the shape of an enzyme and the shape of the substrate. This is why originally the functions or the general way in which enzymes function was called the lock and key hypothesis, by analogy with the tight fit between the shape of a key and the corresponding shape of the lock, right? The wrong shaped key will not fit into the same lock. Well, that's a good analogy, but it actually isn't quite as descriptive as what we are looking at here, which is called the induced fit model. Before I actually define induced fit, let me first say that on the surface of a given enzyme, there is a special place on that surface, which is called the active site. The active site is special because that's the place where the substrate actually fits in. Just like on a lock, it really doesn't matter what the outside shape of the lock is as long as it has the right shape for the key, right? So the active site is the important part as far as working as a catalyst is concerned. And that's somewhere on its shape. It's labeled here. Unlike a lock and key, which doesn't involve any changes in shape, right? You just put the key in. The key is the same shape. The lock is the same shape. Nothing has changed. They fit each other. But unlike that, what we have in real enzyme substrate complexes is that there is a pretty good fit already between the substrate and the active site of the enzyme, which is why it can come in there and bond. This is yet another example of a ligand, which is a general word, right? Something that binds to something, and that something that it binds to is almost always a protein of some sort, which an enzyme is. What do I keep telling you the general consequence of a ligand binding to a protein is? A change in shape, or a conformational change. Right, we talked about it for signal transduction, for all kinds of examples. This is another example. So this is why we use the word induced fit. When a substrate binds to the active site of an enzyme, since that is a binding of a ligand to a protein, you get a shape change in the protein, which is the enzyme. And the shape change is such that the fit between the enzyme and the substrate gets even better. Kind of gives it a little hug. Or an analogy would be a handshake. The lock and key would be like just a limp handshake. But induced fit is like someone grabbing your hand and there's a much better fit between the two hands because of that movement. So that's what happens. Induced means to bring about. The fit is induced. It's made even better. It's brought about by the fact that there's a shape change in the enzyme due to the initial bonding of the substrate to the active site. Now, 16. This cyclic diagram that we see here illustrates well the reusability of catalysts in general, and enzymes are catalysts, of course. I've already told you this, but you see a picture of the fact that since an enzyme is not a reactant and therefore doesn't get turned into a product, enzymes are reusable over and over. But this is the general way in which it happens. You have some number of substrates, not necessarily two. It could be one, but this is using two, that fit into the substrate, into the active site of the enzyme. That causes induced fit, a shape change that makes that fit even better. And something happens that will make it much more likely for the reaction to occur because the activation energy is lower, doesn't it? How that happens specifically depends on the enzyme. But one way, for instance, if you're talking about a situation where a substrate gets split like sucrose into glucose and fructose that we looked at earlier, the binding to the enzyme might, and the shape change that results, might stress the bonds, making them much easier to break. That's one way activation energy can be released. Or if you think about it, that would be a catabolic example. If you had an anabolic enzyme where two substrates come in and they get joined together, well, maybe the activation energy gets lowered because the way the enzyme is shaped, those two substrates coming in are going to fit only in a certain orientation, which will be just the right orientation to get them together. Whereas without the enzyme, they would have to just randomly come together at the right way. So that's just another way. But whatever it does, the activation energy is lowered. And the substrate, well, the combination of substrate and enzyme is called the enzyme-substrate complex. The reaction occurs, and so now we have product temporarily still bound to the enzyme, but that is then released. And when it's released, you no longer have a ligand binding to the protein, right? So it will snap back into its unbound position again and be available to do exactly the same thing again as if there's more substrate available. So enzymes don't get used up. They will continue to work as long as the protein exists. And this actually brings up an important point. I talked about enzymes as ways that cells can control their reactions, right? Turn them on or off, because without the help of an enzyme, the reactions are so slow that they're effectively off. So you can control which pathways get turned on by controlling enzymes. But once you have the enzyme there, it's going to continue working whether you want it to or not. And really an important part of the control of pathways is that enzymes don't get allowed to hang around forever. They'll work for a while, but they will be destroyed so that they don't continue working indefinitely. You don't want them to continue working after they've done their job enough. Okay, 17. More graphs to look at. Both of these have rate of reaction on the y-axis. So rate of reaction refers to how well the reaction is proceeding, how fast it's proceeding. But in terms of goals, you want the reaction to happen. And so the faster it's happening, the better, right? Well, we have two traces in this top one for which X is temperature. These are two different enzymes. They do the same thing, but they're taken from two different organisms. So they operate in the organism that they come from, of course, but they do the same thing in those two organisms. The black one is from a human. The red one is from a thermophilic bacterium. Thermophilic means heat-loving, right? These thermophilic bacteria not only tolerate temperatures that would kill just about anything else on Earth, they actually prefer it. They actually thrive at those temperatures that would kill us. Okay, but let's just look at the black trace. Any given individual point along this trace is a combination of X and Y, right? A temperature and a rate. And so the higher is better. The peak of that trace corresponds to a specific specific temperature here, right? In other words, for this particular enzyme with the black trace, there is one particular temperature at which that enzyme does its job the best. If you get it temperature lower or higher than that optimum temperature, then the reaction might still be occurring, but it's not occurring as quickly. So any given enzyme has a so-called optimal temperature, the temperature at which it performs its job the best, the most efficiently. Why is it that there's an optimal temperature? Well, I've talked about this before, too. Specifically when I was introducing acid precipitation, whatever chapter that was. I've told you then, and actually multiple times since then, that there are two major variables. There's all kinds of variables, but two big variables as far as their effect on the shapes of protein are concerned. And enzymes are proteins, right? Those two big variables that only take a little change to have a big effect in the shape are temperature and pH. So on the top, we're looking at changes in temperature. Remember we talked about denaturation and renaturation, or any shape change due to temperature? That's what's happening here. If you get too low or too high, the shape change is such that the enzyme doesn't work as well. And if the temperature gets really low, it'll be so disformed that it won't work at all. So it's just like it's not even there. Well, notice that when you get up to about 47 or so, that's so hot for a human enzyme that it denatures it permanently. It's worthless. Has no rate. Doesn't work. But that temperature that would be so high as to totally deactivate the human enzyme is still too low, actually, to make this similar enzyme in the thermophilic bacterium work. Because it's a different protein. It does the same job, but it's not going to have its best shape until you get up to almost 80 centigrade, which would kill a human. And this, of course, is because over many generations, natural selection has selected for the shapes that work for the particular environment in which the organisms live. All right? The bottom is the same kind of graph, except here is pH instead of temperature. And these two enzymes are from the same organism. These are from a human. They do the same thing once again, but they do it in different places. These are digestive enzymes that we're looking at. One works in the stomach. One works in the small intestine. And the stomach has a much lower pH because of the hydrochloric acid that the stomach secretes than the duodenum does, the first part of the small intestine, which is where most of the digestion of proteins occurs. This is specifically a digestion for proteins, break them into amino acids. And so a little bit is done in the stomach by pepsin that operates best at a pH below 2. That's very, very acidic, which the stomach is, so it's perfect for that environment. Well, when the contents of the stomach, which is called chyme, used to be food, but now it's food with a bunch of stuff mixed in it, when that gets passed on to the small intestine, the pepsin is still there, the enzyme is still there, but now it's all of a sudden in a much more neutral pH, higher pH here, closer to 7. And that changes the shape of pepsin so much that it stops working. right? It's way beyond its upper range of working. But that's no problem, because then a different enzyme to do the same job that's appropriate for that pH is secreted by the small intestine that works well at that slightly basic pH. All right, the enzyme here is the purple thing, as you see. Everything we've been talking about up to this point is pictured in A. This is normal binding, meaning there's a particular place on the enzyme that's called the active site, and the specific substrate for which this enzyme works is able to fit into that active site. We've already talked about all of that. What we haven't talked about is B and C. And so an enzyme can be inhibited, meaning more or less turned off, at least turned down, or maybe completely inactivated. I mentioned earlier that that enzymes get destroyed after a while. That's, of course, inhibition. That's completely eliminating them as enzymes. But enzymes, without actually being destroyed, can be switched on or off. And to switch an enzyme off is called inhibition. Switching them on, which we'll talk about in a minute, is called activation. All right. So in B, notice that it's labeled as competitive inhibition. It's inhibition, first of all, because the enzyme is not going to work in this situation. It's being turned off. But why is it competitive inhibition? Well, look at what's happening in the cartoon. The blue thing is not a substrate, and it does not get turned into product by this enzyme. But the blue thing, which is called a competitive inhibitor, is a particle that has a similar enough shape to the natural substrate, the real substrate, the teal colored thing, that it will fit into the active site of the enzyme. It just doesn't get turned into anything. Since it's the active site, though, that this inhibitor is binding to, what that means is it's filling the space that the substrate needs to come in to bind to. It would be like putting super glue in a lock. You could no longer get the key in there, right? And therefore, nothing would happen as far as unlocking is concerned. So this is why it's called competitive inhibition. It's competitive because the substrate and the inhibitor are both competing for the same active site on an enzyme. And if the competitive inhibitor is in that active site, then the enzyme is still there, of course, but it might as well not be there because the substrate can't bind when the active site is filled. For as long as that inhibitor is in place, that enzyme is turned off. And therefore, whatever reaction it controls or catalyzes is also turned off. So inhibition is a way to quickly control whether a reaction occurs or not. We also, though, have what is called non-competitive inhibition. And this is non-competitive because it's not true in this case that the substrate and the inhibitor here is the pinkish one, are competing for the same place on the enzyme. The substrate binds to the active site, or it's the only place that it can bind to. In this case, the inhibitor binds to some other place on the enzyme other than the active site. That's why it's non-competitive. But if the active site is not being blocked by the inhibitor, which it's not in C, why does that still inhibit the enzyme? Why can't the substrate bind to the active site?
Because the non-competitive inhibitor changes the active site to no longer fit the substrate.
That's right. We have yet another example of a ligand binding to a protein. The inhibitor here is a ligand. The protein is the enzyme. The general consequence of the binding is a shape change. Well, in this case, the shape change is such that the shape of the active site changes, even though the active site is still open, it's no longer the right shape for as long as that non-competitive inhibitor is bound to the enzyme. The enzyme is off. Okay? But it doesn't have to, the inhibitor, just like it has come to bind and wasn't there always, it's not always going to be there either. It can come back off. And when that happens, the enzyme will go back into its other shape, in which case it will no longer be inhibited. The substrate can bind.
Just to ask,
yeah.
When the non-competitive inhibitor changes the shape of the enzyme, does that mean a different substrate can be attached to the active site and change, then cause a different reaction?
Theoretically. I just don't know if there are real examples of that actually occurring. But yeah, there's nothing saying that that is chemically impossible.
Okay.
By the way, looking at these cartoons and just thinking about this in common sense terms, I hope it makes sense to you that if you have a situation that's competitive, that has to be inhibition, right? You're not going to have the possibility of non-competitive activation. You're not going to turn this enzyme on by blocking the active site ever, right? And competitive means the active site gets blocked. So if it's a competitive situation, that's always going to be inhibition. Does that make sense? On the other hand, non-competitive regulation can be either inhibition or activation. And by the way, we use a different word other than non-competitive, or we can use a different word, which is allosteric. Allosteric regulation refers to the general situation in which some sort of regulatory particle, could be an inhibitor or an activator, binds to some place on the enzyme other than the active site. But the shape change that results changes the active site. There's two possibilities, though. The active site can be changed into a shape that works, or it can be changed into a shape that doesn't work. That's why there's allosteric inhibition. That's what non-competitive inhibition is. Or allosteric activation. You can see that in the next slide, 19. This typically happens in comparatively large enzymes that are multimeric, which is why you see here that there's four subunits. So this is an enzyme, but it's really four enzymes in one, because each subunit has an identical active site, meaning it can work on four individual copies of a substrate molecule. All right, so this is one form of the enzyme. And notice the oscillation arrows. Meaning it's moving back and forth between this active form and this inactive form. And it's doing this many, many times per second. It's flipping back and forth because they're about equal in energy. So just the thermal movement of things is causing it to go back and forth in between shapes. Just like monosaccharides go back and forth between linear and ring shape. But only one of these shapes works as far as an enzyme is concerned. The active form is the only one that will work. Okay, now we have the green thing. That is an allosteric regulator, but specifically it's an allosteric activator in this case. Because when it comes along, if it is there, it will bind right here, any one of these four crevices, and that will lock the overall enzyme into the active form. It can no longer oscillate back to the inactive form. It's like putting a wedge in there, as you see. And that's why it's an activator, because the presence of this allosteric regulator activates the enzyme, turns it on. While it's oscillating, even if substrate is there, it doesn't have time to fit in there before it oscillates back into the inactive form. This locks it in, stabilizes it into the active form. But you also have a different regulator, the red thing, which is an allosteric inhibitor. And if it's there, it will lock it into the inactive form, keeping it turned off. And either one of those is appropriate. It just depends on the situation within the cell. Sometimes you want to lock it on, sometimes you want to lock it off. Now, there's other ways you can control enzymes. or can you can. There's other ways you can control the pathway. You have to have the enzyme working to control it, to turn it on, the reaction. You have to not have the enzyme working to turn it off. But you can turn it on, I mean, you can turn it off, as I said earlier, by destroying the enzyme, right? And that does happen. But if the next moment you need that to be turned on again, you're kind of out of luck because you just destroyed the enzyme that can do the job for you. It's not the end of the world because you can always go back to the DNA library to find the gene that codes for that particular protein. That's what genes do, right? In other words, you can build a new version of the enzyme. It'll be identical to the one you destroyed later. But that's going to take energy and time. It's much more efficient if you keep enzymes around for longer and just turn them on or off with these regulators. That's what's happening there. Now, another slide about control of pathways is shown in 20.
Feedback inhibition.
Yeah, we have feedback inhibition here, and it's called that it's because something gets fed back into an earlier point in the process. The process here is a pathway, and once again, the specific example doesn't really matter, but let's look at the example. The initial reactant, what you enter the pathway as, is threonine. And since it's a pathway, it's not just one reaction, right? It's multiple reactions end to end. Each one feeds the next one. So you turn that into intermediate A, whatever that is. That gets turned in by in the next reaction to intermediate B, and so on until you finally have isoleucine. Okay, as you already know, each step along the way requires its own specific enzyme to catalyze that step. All right, now isoleucine is the goal here; it's the final product. So it would be appropriate for the cell to undergo this pathway if the cell needs isoleucine. That's how you get isoleucine, by running the pathway. As long as the pathway runs, isoleucine more and more gets produced. That will still be appropriate if the cell is still using up the isoleucine that's being produced. In other words, if it still needs more. We're talking about feedback, and we've already talked about feedback in an earlier unit in general, right? In feedback mechanisms, control is exercised. It's part of homeostasis. But what kind of feedback does that?
Negative
feedback. And what is it about negative feedback that allows for homeostasis? What does negative feedback accomplish as far as the error is concerned? It sets the variable closer to the set point, which means it reduces the error. It's trying to negate the error, right? It makes the error smaller. Well, if this pathway keeps running, eventually there's going to be a time where the cell doesn't need any more isoleucine. It has enough. But the pathway is going to produce it anyway, right? And so the error in that case is going to be too much isoleucine.
Positive feedback.
No. Great. Positive feedback never leads to homeostasis. It always makes the error even bigger. But for at the moment, we have the error, which is too much isoleucine. Okay?
Too much product.
If it's no longer being used up, it's accumulating. And the more it accumulates, the more likely it is to interact with things. Well, it just happens, it doesn't just happen, it's not a coincidence, that isoleucine acts as an allosteric inhibitor to the enzyme on step one. In other words, isoleucine can bind to that enzyme somewhere other than the active site and change the active site into a non-functional shape. And therefore, you shut down this step one, right? Well, if you shut down step one, you're no longer making intermediate A, so you shut down the entire pathway by shutting down just one step. You could shut down enzyme 5, and that would still accomplish shutting down the pathway. You would be no longer making any more isoleucine. But it's much more efficient to feed it back to the original step, because then you don't bother making these intermediates that you don't need either. It's more efficient to nip it in the bud, basically, turn off step 1. But notice what that accomplishes. You right away don't let the error get any worse, and then eventually the isoleucine that's on hand will be used up by the cell until you run out. And when it runs out, there's so little isoleucine present that it will diffuse away from the enzymes that it's bound to, and that will automatically turn them back on. Right?
Yeah.
Which is appropriate, because when you're out of isoleucine, you want to turn this pathway back on to make more. That's exactly how feedback inhibition works.
A good way of saying it would be when the product... feedback inhibition is with the product of a non-competitive inhibitor itself.
That's right, which is another way of saying allosteric inhibitor.
Yeah.
Right, and it's usually specifically an allosteric inhibitor of an early enzyme, if yeah. not the very first, then at least an early place in the pathway. All right, that is the first chapter. Any questions before I switch? All right. Switch recordings.